From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, the life and music of Bessie Smith, who is widely considered the greatest blues singer of all time. We talk with Chris Albertson. He's just published a new revised edition of his 1972 biography. Also, we talk with performance artist Rodessa Jones. She's best known for her one-woman show, Big Butt Girls, Hard-Headed Women, based on the lives of women who are in prison. She runs a theater workshop for women in prison. Critics of the Supreme Court's decision to overturn the Texas sodomy law have used the expression slippery slope. Our linguist Jeff Nunberg has been tracking the expression. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. The Israeli and Palestinian prime ministers held a joint news conference in Jerusalem to underscore their commitment to the peace process. Israel's Ariel Sharon and Palestinian Mahmoud Abbas met today to discuss their next steps in establishing security. The major Palestinian militant groups agreed on Sunday to stop attacking Israelis for 3 months, but some smaller factions have said they won't observe the ceasefire. Israeli soldiers said they killed a Palestinian gunman in the West Bank today after he opened fire on a checkpoint. The top civilian administrator in Iraq says professional commandos from Saddam Hussein's former army are probably behind the recent attacks on U.S. military personnel. Paul Bremer denied that attacks are being coordinated at a central level. NPR's Guy Raz reports from Baghdad.
Bremer said that recent intelligence suggests the attacks are being carried out by Saddam loyalists.
It looks to us as if a number of these attacks are quite professional. That is to say, they are conducted by people who probably had experience in the intelligence services or in the military.
While Bremer acknowledged the recent surge in attacks, he said they were expected and insisted they wouldn't obstruct the process of reconstruction in Iraq. Nearly 24 American troops have been killed in assault since major fighting ended in Iraq on May 1st. Another 6 British soldiers have died. There has been speculation that some of the attacks may have been planned by the ousted regime shortly before its fall on April 9th. Guy Raz, NPR News, Baghdad.
Gunmen killed the chief of Saddam Hussein's tribe today in the former president's hometown of Tikrit. It was unclear whether Abdullah al-Khattab was assassinated because he recently disavowed Saddam. Hundreds of people lined the streets of Columbia, South Carolina today to watch the funeral procession of former Senator Strom Thurmond. NPR's Adam Hochberg reports.
The senator's casket was carried on a horse-drawn caisson from the state capitol to a nearby church. In an elaborate funeral, Thurmond was remembered as a dedicated public servant and a World War II hero. Vice President Dick Cheney said the South Carolina political icon never took his office or his constituents for granted.
He was sincerely grateful for the chance to serve, and we saw that gratitude every day in Strom's daily work ethic. It was a life of steady, tireless effort on behalf of South Carolina and its people.
In another eulogy, Delaware Senator Joe Biden said he saw Thurmond change over the years from an ardent segregationist into a supporter of civil rights. Thurmond died last week at the age of 100. Adam Hochberg, NPR News, Columbia, South Carolina.
In stocks, the Dow gained 55 points to close at 9,040. The Nasdaq gained 17 points to close at 1640. This is NPR News. A Milwaukee judge has ordered compensation for a woman whose son was beaten to death by a mob of children and young adults. Marty Mickelson reports from member station WUWM in Milwaukee.
A judge granted Fannie Young $1 million in compensation to cover her son's medical and funeral expenses, pain and suffering, and loss of life. The judgment orders the parents of the defendants to come up with the money. But Fannie Young's attorney says his client will probably never see a penny of it because the families are too poor to pay the settlement. The judgment, however, guarantees that if any of the attackers writes a book on the subject, they must give the profits to Charlie Young's family. Young was beaten to death last fall by a mob of mostly children who used bats, broomsticks, shovels, and milk crates to pummel him. 15 young people were initially charged in the beating and have received sentences ranging from 18 months to 18 years after reaching plea agreements. For NPR News, I'm Marty Michelson in Milwaukee.
The panel investigating the Columbia disaster says NASA needs to do a better job of filming its shuttles during liftoff. Investigators say the space agency might have taken damage to the shuttle more seriously if it had gotten better images of the wing after it was hit by a piece of foam insulation. Two of NASA's launch cameras did provide images of the foam striking the wing, but didn't give a good view of the damage. A third camera that might have provided a better view wasn't working properly. Investigators believe that a breach in the wing led to the shuttle's breakup as it re-entered the Earth's atmosphere, killing all seven astronauts. In stocks today, the S&P 500 gained 8 points to close at 982. Corey Flintoff, NPR News, Washington.
Support for NPR comes from Enterprise Florida and the Metro Orlando Economic Development Commission, putting imagination to work. Orlando, an emerging center of technology. OrlandoEDC.com.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. My guest, Chris Albertson, has written a new edition of his 1972 biography of Bessie Smith, which was considered the definitive biography when it was published. Albertson first heard Bessie Smith on the radio when he was a teenager growing up in Copenhagen. Her music led him to a lifelong passion for blues and jazz. In 1970, he moved to the United States to pursue his interest in the music. Albertson convinced Columbia Records to reissue Bessie Smith's recordings, which they owned. He produced the reissues and wrote the liner notes. He won a Grammy Award in 1971. The reissue's success led to his biography of Smith. Albertson has also been a longtime contributor to many magazines and has written extensive liner notes for jazz and blues albums. He's produced many recordings as well as radio and TV programs. Let's start with this 1933 Bessie Smith recording, Do Your Duty. Bessie Smith died in 1937. The story of her death has become one of the legends of music history. But when Chris Albertson was writing his biography of Smith, he learned the legend was just that. It wasn't what really happened. Here's the story the way it used to be told.
The story was that she was in a car accident, and that part of it was correct. But then the story went on to say that she was taken to a hospital in Memphis. That was wrong because it wasn't Memphis, it was Clarksdale, Mississippi. And that hospital, being a white hospital, had turned her away because she was black, because that was the policy down there. And as a consequence of that, Bessie Smith allegedly bled to death. So she was a victim of racism.
How did you find out that this story wasn't actually true?
Well, I was suspicious to begin with because of the fact that there was a black hospital within a half a mile of the white one, so it didn't make any sense that she would be taken there. So that started it. Then I looked through old Downbeats, as a matter of fact, and I came across a story by George Hafer, who was trying to find out what really happened. He obviously didn't believe what happened. And he mentioned a doctor, Hugh Smith, who had been on the scene of the accident and was an intern at the Campbell Clinic in Memphis. And it turned out that Dr. Smith was still there. He was now the head of the clinic. And so I mentioned to him that I was trying to get to the truth of the death of Bessie Smith. He said, oh, I don't want to talk about that. I'm so sick and tired of all these stories, and they're all lies, and I've just decided I'm not going to talk about it. And he said, I'll tell you one thing. Columbia has just put out some new LPs on Bessie Smith, and you read the liner notes there, and you'll find the closest to the truth. And I said, well, I wrote those liner notes. He said, I'll talk to you. And he really did. He had a tape recorder at home, so he sat down that following Sunday. I had sent him some questions. And he just sat down and told in great detail what he remembered from the accident.
Would you sum that up for us, what he remembered?
Sure. What really happened was Bessie was driving her old, she wasn't driving, she was riding in it, and her lover, who was also her manager, Lionel Hampton's uncle, was driving the car. And it was just the two of them going on Route 61, a very, very dark, very straight road, mesmerizingly straight, as the doctor put it. And there was a large truck that from Nabisco, and the driver of that truck thought something was wrong with one of his tires. He had stopped the truck. He pulled over a little bit to the side of the road and went to check the tire and found out nothing was wrong. And he had gotten back into the truck. And in those days, those trucks accelerated very slowly. So as he was driving, off and continuing his journey, Bessie's car came, and Richard Morgan, who was driving it, suddenly realized, apparently, that he was going to hit this truck. So he veered to the left to avoid it. Bessie had her arm out the window, which was normal in those days. They didn't have air conditioning in the cars. And Bessie's arm apparently hit the back of the truck as it veered, turned over Bessie's car, and Bessie was thrown out. And so she was lying in the middle of the road. And the truck driver didn't stop to check it out. He just kept right going. So moments after that, while the tail lights of the truck are still visible, this Dr. Smith, the intern from the Campbell Clinic, is going on a fishing trip with a Mr. Broughton, who is a friend of his. And they come across the accident. All of a sudden, they see Bessie lying there in the middle of the road in his headlights. And they see the red lights of the truck disappearing into the darkness. And Richard Morgan running around totally dazed and hysterical. So he is being a doctor. He goes right over and checks Bessie. And she's not conscious, but she was bleeding, apparently bleeding internally, but her arm was almost severed. And so he sends Mr. Broughton to a nearby house to call an ambulance, and which Mr. Broughton does. But when he comes back and they wait and there's still no ambulance, they finally decide to move the fishing gear from the back of the car and put Bessie there. But while they're doing that, another car comes from the same direction, and it turns out to be a young white couple who had been partying and a little bit high and didn't see the doctor's car, and smashed right into the doctor's car, pushed that against the wreck of Bessie's car. Then suddenly, shortly after that, two ambulances show up, one from the white hospital, one from the black. It turns out that Broughton, of course, knew that Bessie was black, so he had called a black hospital. But the truck driver had gone right to a hospital, gone to the white hospital, and said, there's an accident up the road. He didn't know whether the people were black or white, so he just went to the white hospital. So therefore, these two ambulances came, and the black one took Bessie, and the white one took the couple. And that was it.
And Bessie Smith died of blood loss?
Bessie Smith, when she got to the hospital, the doctor had to sever her arm. And he said she never regained consciousness. She was bleeding internally, and she died at 10 o'clock that morning.
Let's talk a little bit about Bessie Smith's life. She was born in Chattanooga, grew up in a little shack. Her father was a laborer and a preacher. When she got a little older, she started on the Black Vaudeville circuit. Would you describe the circuit that she started on?
Well, she really started with a sort of a small touring company that would come and appear in little storefront theaters, nothing fancy. And her brother, Clarence, her older brother, had gone away with a show, had left Chattanooga, and he came back with the show in 1912. And Bessie begged him to take her with him when he left. And so he arranged for an audition, but they didn't hire her as a singer, they hired her as a dancer. And it was the Moses Stokes Company. And it just so happened they'd had a singer already, and her name was Gertrude Rainey, and that was Ma Rainey. So there, another myth came about that, you know, that it was Ma Rainey who trained Bessie's voice, which was not true. I think Ma Rainey probably taught her stage presence. She might well have done that. They were very good friends.
So how did Bessie Smith make the transition from dancing in the same group that Ma Rainey was singing in to becoming a singer herself?
Well, because Bessie had been singing before she went on to the show, before she left Chattanooga with the show where she was hired as a dancer. She had been singing on street corners in Chattanooga. So she was actually a singer, but the reason they hired her as a dancer is because they didn't need another singer. They had Ma Rainey, and they didn't want two singers. So she became a dancer. Then, of course, as soon as she got an opportunity to sing in other shows, when she got to the 81 Theater in Atlanta, she started singing, and apparently anyone who heard her sing realized that that's what she should be doing.
Now, Bessie Smith not only sang blues songs, she sang a fair amount of Tin Pan Alley songs like Alexander's Ragtime Band or There'll Be a Hot Time in the Old Town Tonight. How did she start singing that material as part of her repertoire?
I think she always did. I mean, I remember Ida Cox, the blues singer. I asked her about her when she started singing, and she said, well, the first song I sang was Put Your Arms Around Me, Honey. And Alberta Hunter, who was a great friend of mine, she started with Where the River Shannon Flows. And so they weren't really blues singers per se. They could sing anything. It didn't matter to them whether it was a blues or not. But then when the blues came into vogue after Mamie Smith's recording of Crazy Blues sold a lot of copies, then, of course, there was a concentration on the blues. But basically, most of the singers, you would not term them as blues singers. They were Tin Pan Alley singers who sang blues. So it was not difficult for someone like Bessie Smith to take After You've Gone or any of those Tin Pan Alley songs. And in later life, towards the end, in the beginning of the 30s, when she realized that the times were changing and tastes were changing, the blues had had their run, she started singing, and I'm so sorry we never saw any recordings of it, songs like Tea for Two and Smoke Gets in Your Eyes.
Wow, I would have liked to hear that.
Yes.
Well, let's hear one of the Tin Pan Alley songs she did record. Do you want to choose a favorite?
Well, I love After You've Gone. I think she does a wonderful job. Even when she does songs that are not blues, they almost sound like blues, the way she treats them. And I think After You've Gone is a good example of that.
Well, let's hear it. This is Bessie Smith.
Grow lonely, your heart will break like mine, and you
Bessie Smith recorded in 1927. We'll talk more with her biographer, Chris Albertson, after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Chris Albertson. He's just written a revised edition of his 1972 biography of Bessie Smith. Another new piece of Bessie Smith's biography that you presented in your biography of her is that Bessie Smith was bisexual. How did you learn that?
I learned that originally from Ruby Smith, Bessie's niece by marriage, who toured with her for 14 years. And told me all kinds of stories about what was going on backstage. And then, of course, I also spoke to Bessie's sister-in-law, Maud Smith, who was married to Clarence Smith, Bessie's brother, who was a comedian with the show and sort of a manager at one point. And she confirmed all that. And I've subsequently met some older Harlem residents who remembered Bessie as being a lesbian. But she wasn't really a lesbian. She just had a huge sexual appetite and didn't matter to her, it was male or female.
Bessie Smith's husband was Jack G. What was their marriage like?
Well, you heard the expression roller coaster. This was a roller coaster. You know, he was a very straight-laced guy. He was a night watchman in Philadelphia, who liked to pretend that he had been a policeman, even had his picture taken in a sort of a policeman's uniform. And he never understood show business life. He met Bessie one night. He heard her at Horan's, and he liked her, and they finally got together. But when they married and he came on the road and he saw the way things went backstage and the sort of the hedonistic life they led, he was appalled by it. But he loved the money, and he saw the money coming in, so that justified everything. But he still never really went along with show business life. And so he didn't like all that, you know, drinking and partying. So when he was around, Bessie didn't drink. And like Ruby said, sometimes when he was around, if you mentioned something, a party you'd all been to or something in front of him, Bessie would shut you up because she didn't even want to talk about these things when he was there. But then the minute he left, and he used to go on these hunting trips, quote unquote, and he was always hunting, and then Bessie would let loose and have her various affairs and so forth. And the minute he showed up, and he always showed up sort of with a surprise. I mean, he never announced it in advance. He would just suddenly be there. And then the whole show was afraid of him because they would have a fight, and then they would calm down the next day, and then she would be all right until he left again.
What was Bessie Smith's image like on stage?
From all accounts, of course, I never saw her, unfortunately, but from all accounts, she was, there was something mesmerizing about her. She just had an enormous presence. And one thing that people always point out to me is that her movements, when she sang, were very subtle. You know, she'd raise an eyebrow, she'd shift a hip just a little bit, you know. They were never, for instance, I saw a Broadway show called Me and Bessie with Linda Hopkins. And everything was exaggerated. All the movements are exaggerated. But that's not how Bessie was. Bessie just was very, very, very sexy, they said.
You know, Bessie Smith is considered a blues singer, but on her recordings, it's not like she's being accompanied by Mississippi Delta bottleneck guitarists. She's mostly accompanied by jazz musicians, people like Fletcher Henderson's band and Louis Armstrong. Can you talk a little bit about that pairing of Bessie Smith and jazz musicians?
Well, it's because they didn't really distinguish that. I mean, it was black music. You know, black music was black music. When you appeared in vaudeville in these theaters, you had they were jazz musicians. They weren't, you know, dance band musicians in the pit. So it was just a natural thing. Of course, Bessie did make some records with out-and-out dance band musicians. Terrible, terrible accompaniments, but she overcame them always. But she mostly was accompanied by jazz people. I mean, you know, Clarence Williams was considered a jazz person, but he wasn't much of a pianist. James P. Johnson, on the other hand, was one of the, you know, most fantastic pianists of that period and was the perfect accompaniment for her. But Bessie didn't always choose her, or in fact, she may never have chosen her accompaniments. I haven't found any evidence that she ever did. But Frank Walker did.
Her producer?
Yes.
How popular was Bessie Smith's music when she died?
Bessie Smith's music was not very popular when she died. This was 1937. There was swing music. So it wasn't about the blues. Still probably popular in the South, in the rural areas of the South. But basically not that popular. And Bessie knew it, and that's why she was changing her whole approach to the music and moving with the new trends.
Well, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
You're very welcome. I enjoyed it.
Chris Albertson, he's just written a revised and expanded edition of his 1972 biography of Bessie Smith. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. Here's Bessie Smith and Louis Armstrong, recorded in 1925.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Barnes & Noble Booksellers and the Discover Great New Writers Program, which features the literary voices of tomorrow today. Information available at Barnes & Noble stores and on the web at www.bn.com. From the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and by the National Endowment for the Arts, this is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, actress, director, and dancer Rodessa Jones. She's founder of the Medea Project, a performance workshop for women in prison. Critics of the Supreme Court decision to overturn the Texas sodomy law have used the expression slippery slope. Our linguist Jeff Nunberg has been tracking the expression. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. My guest, Rodessa Jones, is an actress, director, and dancer. She's the co-artistic director of the San Francisco performance company Cultural Odyssey. Her brother is the choreographer and dancer Bill T. Jones. Rodessa Jones is best known for her one-woman shows, like Hot Flashes, Power Surges, and Private Summers, and Big Butt Girls, Hard-Headed Women, which she'll bring to the National Black Theater Festival next month. Big Butt Girls is a series of monologues based on the stories of women in prison. Jones has worked with many women in prison through the Medea Project, a program of workshops for incarcerated women, which she founded and directs. She often talks about her life to the women to help get them talking about theirs. A heads up to parents, parts of our discussion may not be appropriate for young children. You said one of the parts of your life that you like to share with the women in prison that you work with is the fact that you became a mother at the age of 16.
Mm-hmm.
Imagine a lot of the women in prison you've worked with became mothers at a young age, probably
yeah.
even younger than you.
Yeah.
This might be much too personal, so you could just tell me to back mm-hmm. off on this one. But I know one of the characters that you're working on now is Rubber Girl, and it's going to be a very kind of pro-condom
mm-hmm.
type
mm-hmm.
of character. When you were 16 and got pregnant, did you think at all about birth control?
Oh, no. We're talking 1964. I was in love. the father of my daughter was attending Cornell University. I was so impressed that he was a college boy, and he even said to me, "He put Vaseline on his penis, if I may say that on the radio, and said to me that I wasn't going to get pregnant, you know, and because I was very afraid of getting pregnant, just because." It all around me, women didn't seem very happy. You know, women that were married, and that had been not a part of my plan for myself. But this boy assured me that he had been to college, and he was not going to let anything happen to me. This is almost verbatim, you know. And at 16, no. But my body stopped. That was the only child I ever had, and I think that it really had to do with how traumatic that was for me.
You mean you couldn't have children after that?
No, never again.
Wow. Huh.
Never again. I think it had to do with I'm never going to be caught in this situation again.
Was that just as well as far as you were concerned that you never got pregnant again?
Yes, I've fallen in love later in my life, and there's been a couple of men that maybe, but my daughter's a joy and my granddaughter's a joy. And it's to have three or four kids, oh, my God, you know, just feeding them and taking care of them and rearing them is a lot, you know.
When you figured out that Vaseline wasn't a particularly effective form of birth control, you must have been furious with this guy.
I was just devastated because then he did really a mean thing to me, and I think it was he implied that I was just a loose girl, you know. Obviously, I had to be loose because I'd had sex with him. And he named a couple of people that, you know, he supposedly had heard. You know, it was very painful and very sad, you know.
When people use their age and their college education to to lie to you, that's a scary thing.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And I so wanted him to be the one,
uh-huh.
you know. I don't know where it came from. Maybe it's just my mother and her caustic pride, but I never just wanted any simple old guy. I, you know, to meet a colored boy in 1964 who was going to school, middle class boy. He had had uncles. He had gone to West Point. I mean, he was that kind of a boy. And but in support of him, I think he was just as scared because later his father said some terrible things to him in my presence about laying down with nigger gals, and we were all black. You know, so it's back to self-loathing and, you know, and an attempt at a deeper understanding of what life brings us, yeah.
How did your mother find out that you were pregnant?
She came in the bathroom and I was in the bathtub. And my mother had had 17 pregnancies and 12 of us lived. And so my mother just took one look at me and knew that I was pregnant. And that was scary. It was just she was so upset and so furious and disappointed, you know. And she wanted me to marry this boy right away. She wanted me to marry him. And I just said that, you know, Mom, I don't think he wants to marry me. And if he doesn't want to marry me, I don't want to marry him. And later she said to me, she said, when you told your father and I that, we talked about it till deep in the night. And I think for my mother, this woman, it made some sense, you know, on some level, that why should I be stuck with some guy who did not want to be with me? I was already stuck with a kid, and they had agreed to help me take care of the child. So I think she understood.
Did you want to have the baby? Did you? This was 1964, did you say?
My daughter was born in 1965.
Okay, so abortion wasn't legal yet.
No. Well, you know,
you could have gotten an illegal abortion. Was that an option you thought about? You could have given the baby away. Was that an option you thought about?
I thought about giving the baby away, but you got to remember, I was a country girl. My mother and father had been migrant workers who had settled in upstate New York from Florida. I lived up on a dirt road. I was really a tomboy, you know, who had sort of fallen in love, because at that time I think all girls were in love with love, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And at the same time, pregnancy had, you know, just was like, what? You know, and it was like, I'm what? And I mean, I was already like 4 or 5 months pregnant when this little girl who was much younger but more worldly told me where babies came out of, and I was terrified.
Oh, you didn't know?
No, I mean, I didn't know. I just didn't know. I mean, I would have never have had sex with this boy with Vaseline if I had had more information. And my poor mother, I think, was just terrified that if she didn't talk about it, we wouldn't get caught. So, no, abortion, a friend of mine, a man I knew, had agreed to take me to New Jersey for an abortion, but that was really totally far-fetched. And my mother told my father, and they both let me know that we were keeping that baby, you know. And my father told me that, you know, you'll understand by and by why this happened to you. And he said to me, please don't give away my blood. He said, if you need to move on, your mother and I will keep her. And if you decide to stay, I will share everything with you. If I have 2 grains of rice, you get one and that baby gets the other, but please don't talk about giving her away.
So did your parents help you raise the baby?
Yes. I was able to go back to school.
That's great.
Back to high school.
Uh-huh.
Yeah. My mother was adamant that I had to go back to school.
Did they let you go? You know, sometimes they throw you out if you're pregnant.
Oh, this is, God bless them, Wayland, New York, Wayland Central School. And so I was told by the principal that I could go to school as long as I could climb the stairs, you know. And I went home after Thanksgiving vacation, and I did not come back until after the 1st of February. My daughter was born January 10th. So it was a very central school in a very small hamlet in upstate New York. And so I think I just kind of blew their minds. You know, 'cause my mother said I was going to school, so I went to school. I was showing, and I went to school. You know, there's no way around that. Yeah.
My guest is actor, dancer, and director Rodessa Jones. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is actor, dancer, and director Rodessa Jones. She founded the Medea Project, Theater for Incarcerated Women. I know you've been thinking a lot about what it means to get older, not elderly, but older,
mm-hmm.
because after you passed 50, you started doing this show about turning 50 and about going through menopause.
Yes, hot flashes, power surges, and private summers.
Exactly, that's the title of the piece.
Yes.
Are there things you promised yourself you wouldn't obsess over when you reach 50, and did you fulfill your promise or not?
I think that's things you can't help.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I mean, getting up out of bed after sleeping all night, getting up, and how hard it is, you know, like physically, to sit up. It's so different, especially for a physical body like mine, to realize, oh my gosh, what is that? Oh, I'm stiff. You know, this kind of a thing. So I work very hard. I just came from the gym. You know, I just ran over here from Goals, and I'm in the gym, but it's more because I want to be able to carry my own water and chop my on wood, even if I'm lucky to live as long as my mother has. But no, I didn't obsess too much because I'm lucky. I'm youthful. The art, my work keeps me in the mix. You know, I had this kid so early that I'm already a grandmother, and my life is designed in such a way as to sort of protect me to some degree. You know, and I don't age like somebody who would obsess ages. I haven't aged that way.
In addition to your autobiographical piece about turning 50, you much earlier did an autobiographical piece about dancing in a peep show to support your daughter after you became a mother. And that's an interesting way for a dancer to start. What a strange relationship you must have with the men on the other side of the wall or the peephole or whatever when they pay their money and you're dancing naked for them.
And they're very, this was back in the day. We're talking 1978, I guess, 79.
So your daughter was already in her early teens?
My daughter was like, she was 13, 14. My daughter made all my tapes for me to dance to. My daughter introduced me to Prince. She induced me to LTD, Bob Seger's Silver Bullet Band.
Well, how'd you feel about mom being a stripper?
Well, see, I just always felt like I had to tell her. I had to tell her that what I'm doing, I'm going to work, I'm working downtown, you know. So she got it from me. I told my brothers because I want them to know where I was. I want them to know that, you know, if they want to check on me, they knew where I was. You know, it was like I was making money. You know, it was like I wasn't a prostitute. I was making the most money I could make fast as I could, you know. But back to the men, I think men are afraid of women. They're definitely afraid of vaginas, you know. That's when I found not working down there. They have no idea what they want from women, you know.
Would they talk with you on the other side of the...
Yeah.
What was it? Was it like a peephole or a wall?
It was a peep show, you know, where you have a curtain and you put money in it, uh-huh. and the little machine, the curtain opens, and you're sitting behind plexiglass, and he can talk into the machine there or into the telephone. Some booths had a telephone, you know, and so they're saying really silly stuff or very violent, mean, dark stuff. Which is the only way they can get off, you know, is to be abusive or to just be silly. I was like the guys who were a little silly. Or I liked younger guys who, you know, who had never, like sailors. San Francisco, you know, the port town. And I remember this young sailor coming in. He must have been 18. I always tell people he was like from Podunk, Iowa or something. And he came in and his friends all opened the window and there was this color girl sitting there. And he came back. He said, "You sure are pretty." And it was just purity, you know. We had a great time that night. He just hung out with me. It was like he just spent his little money in there, and he had never ever been in the company of a colored girl before, you know. And he kept telling me how pretty I was, you know.
Since you are in the theater, and part of what you do is observe people and transform your own personality, you must have been thinking about this, watching the guys relate to you and talk dirty to you. Were you studying them as they were studying you?
Yes, I was writing a lot of things down. I start to formulate questions because I wanted to make a performance about it. And I kept thinking, what's erotic? And what do men want from women and what do women want from men? And why is race and sexism, why are they such perfect bedfellows? I mean, things people would say, things that women backstage would say, you know, because I was a beauty. I mean, legs for days, you know, I mean, the butt, you know, long before all this was popular. I mean, I was, you know, like I said, I was a farm girl. And I was already doing gymnastics and trapeze work, so I was very strong. I could jump up and down those high heel shoes. I could kick. I could roll. And I had this great Donna Summer wig that I wore. I'd always open my show with Muddy Waters. I mean, that was how I opened the show, you know. I Just Want to Make Love to You. It was like Lily's theme music, you know. And
Lily was your persona?
Yeah, Lily Overstreet from New Orleans was the full name. And sometimes the things the girls would say backstage, you know, you know, women can be so mean to each other, too. And also, young white women, again, we're talking 1978, you know, it's around the same time that Moscone was murdered in San Francisco, Harvey Milk, so the air was just electric. But I really did want to, I really wanted to know who the women were backstage as well. And the men outside was like just watching men come and go. And you know, there were priests, you know. There were guys getting off from work. There were lost boys. It was amazing.
You know, you had this experience of like dancing nude in peep shows to support yourself and your daughter. Mm-hmm. And instead of walking away from this experience feeling demeaned, it sounds to me like you walked away thinking like, well, that was pretty interesting. I got a lot out of it. I'm going to do a, you know, theater show based on it.
It's all, you know, it's a journey. It's all an experience.
Well, did you walk into that experience knowing that you'd be able to walk away from it feeling like you were richer and better off because of it as opposed to feeling demeaned as a result of it?
Well, I didn't. I knew that there was a story to tell. When I first got, when I applied for the job, and it was all lesbians running the show backstage, the mafia maybe owned the building, but the lesbians had been brought in from Baltimore, and they were great. And they were the ones who were hiring people. They were the women who had to look at me when I took my clothes off, and they said, "You are beautiful." They didn't want me to wear wigs. You know, they were saying, "You're." One woman said, "You look so much more dignified without it." And I said, "Honey, this is not dignity. I'm trying to pay my rent down here." It's like, but no, it's in. I was not sure about what was going to happen, other than that I knew it was going to be a great adventure. This new dancing.
You've worked with a lot of women in prison, teaching mm-hmm. them certain theater techniques, trying to turn their stories into monologues, theatrical monologues. What do you think they can get out of that?
I think that what I've really learned how to do is impart transformative work, transformative technique that, you know, if you can reinvent yourself to the good of yourself. And I think that that's what they've been able to, you know, get out of working with me, is that we start out very, very simply. You know, there's a series of questions to answer, and then we have conversations. We talk about who we are, who we really are, where we want to go, where we've been. And then we create theater loosely based on a myth that I might find, but really entrenched in who they are. And as we work from 4 to 6 months, I am saying constantly, you know, just 2 months ago, you couldn't do that. Or 2 months ago, you wouldn't have said that. We have video that happens constantly. They can see themselves. So it's about transformation. And I think that they touch upon that. You know, even the ones that don't make it, I see them in the street and they might not be able to remember me, but they'll say, "Remember that class we had in jail?" Thinking I'm an inmate. They said, "But, you know, I still do the hand dance stuff. I still do that when I need to just calm down, you know." So it's just much more, it's more life-saving stuff that I hope I leave with them, you know.
Rhodessa Jones, I thank you so much for talking with us.
Thank you for having me.
Rhodessa Jones is the co-artistic director of the San Francisco performance company Cultural Odyssey and the director of the Medea Project, Theater for Incarcerated Women. She'll perform her shows Big Butt Girls, Hard-Headed Women, and They Speak Through Us at the National Black Theater Festival in Winston-Salem next month. Coming up, linguist Jeff Nunberg on The Slippery Slope. This is Fresh Air. The Supreme Court decision overturning the Texas sodomy law had critics complaining that the country was on a slippery slope that would lead to the legalization of everything from prostitution to adultery. Our linguist Jeff Nunberg has been tracking the expression slippery slope and the rhetorical work it does.
I read last week that Democrats were complaining that the administration's prescription drug bill puts the nation on the slippery slope toward Medicare privatization, that the dismantling of West Bank outposts puts Israel on a slippery slope leading to its destruction, and that the ownership of a women's NBA team by a Connecticut casino sets the sport on a slippery slope toward control by gamblers. And not surprisingly, the metaphor was ubiquitous in condemnations of the Supreme Court's overturning of the Texas sodomy law. Jerry Falwell said that it set the nation down a slippery slope in which courts might approve bestiality, prostitution, and the use of narcotics. To judge from the news stories, the entire nation is coming to resemble San Francisco after a heavy rain. In the press, the phrase slippery slope is more than five times as common as it was 20 years ago. It's a way of warning of the dire effects of some course of action without actually having to criticize the action itself. No wonder it's a favorite ploy of hypocrites. Not that there's anything wrong with A, mind you, but A will lead to B and then C, and before you know it, we'll be up to our armpits in Z. That argument goes by various names. The phrase slippery slope dates from the mid-19th century, around the same time that people started to talk about letting the camel's nose into the tent. That's an allusion to a fable about a camel who asks if he can put his nose into a workman's tent to keep it from the cold, and goes on to insert his shoulders, then his legs, and so on, until he dispossesses the inhabitant. Then there's the domino effect, an analogy that Dwight Eisenhower used in 1954 to justify U.S. intervention in Vietnam. Or people talk about the thin end of the wedge, the snowball effect, the doomsday scenario, or opening the floodgates. One way or another, it always comes down to God knows where it will end. The rhetoric textbooks usually describe the slippery slope as a logical fallacy, but sometimes it can be a reasonable form of argument. When you say that A puts us on a slippery slope to B, you might mean only that A will make it cheaper or easier to implement B. The UCLA law professor Eugene Volokh gives the example of installing video cameras at every intersection. That may make it easier to deter street crime, but it also provides the government with a means to perform more sinister forms of surveillance. Or sometimes the slippery slope is invoked in the course of an argument about the impossibility of making clear moral distinctions. If it's hard to draw the line between A and B, then how can you accept one and reject the other? That's an argument you're always hearing from abortion critics. Where does a fetus end and a child begin? It's an instance of what Greek philosophers called the fallacy of the heap. If you start with a heap of sand and you take one grain away, you're still left with a heap. But if you keep repeating the process, you wind up saying that a single grain of sand is a heap all by itself. That's what comes of assuming that if a distinction isn't clear-cut, it can't be drawn at all. The Supreme Court justices love to torment attorneys with slippery slope examples in an effort to get them to clarify their positions. It's what gives the court transcripts the air of absurdist theater. But the technique is more disconcerting when it moves from the hypothetical to assertions of fact, the way it did in Justice Scalia's dissent in the Texas case. According to Scalia, once you start throwing out laws that reflect the moral choices of the majority, you undermine the basis for state laws against bigamy, same-sex marriage, adult incest, prostitution, masturbation, adultery, and bestiality, among others. I have the feeling that Scalia had a great time drawing up that list, but it's hard to believe he really buys the logic, that the law can't distinguish between masturbation and bestiality beyond saying that many people disapprove of both of them. At least it's hard to see Scalia voting to overturn some state anti-bestiality statute on the grounds that the Texas sodomy decision leaves him no choice. But the real problem with slippery slope arguments isn't their logic, it's the rhetorical games people play with them. They have a way of turning every decision into an unprecedented step into the void. In theory, after all, you could use Scalia's logic to run the metaphor uphill. You could just as easily say that refusing to overturn the Texas statute would open the way to laws restricting nose rings, public dancing, or other things that voters might find morally unacceptable. But nobody ever brings up the slippery slope to argue for a change in law or policy. It's always an argument for maintaining the status quo. The English legal scholar Glanville Williams once called the slippery slope the trump card of the traditionalist, because no proposal for reform is immune to it. That comes with a metaphor of describing a decision as stepping off the edge of a slope. But law and policy decisions are rarely that dramatic. It's more like carving our way along a hillside, making small adjustments as we go. Or to mix the metaphor, we all agree that we want to keep the camel's nose and haunches inside the tent and leave his nether parts out in the desert. The question always comes down to where we want to put the hump.
Jeff Nunberg is a linguist at Stanford University's Center for the Study of Language and Information and the author of The Way We Talk Now. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our engineer is Julian Hertzfeld. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Anne-Marie Baldonado directed today's show. I'm Terry Gross.
Tapes and transcripts of Fresh Air are available at 1-877-213-7374 or on the internet at www.burrells.com. Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and by Bantam Trade Paperbacks, a division of Random House, publisher of The Elegant Gathering of White Snows, a novel about eight women whose impromptu walking quest touches a nation by Chris Radish. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, we talk about the latest developments in the Middle East with James Bennett, Jerusalem Bureau Chief for The New York Times. I'm Terry Gross. Join us for the next Fresh Air.